I'm Bill Castle, and this is Free Expression. This program is all about conveying the Christian message from a Catholic point of view and defending the liberty which makes it possible to do that. We talk with creative, interesting people documenting the lives of famous, influential Catholics from a communist convert to a saintly pope. Join us, sit back, and enjoy some free expression. Archbishop Fulton J. Sheen was one of the pioneers of Catholic mass media. I can recall my parents watching his TV show Life is Worth Living, a network offering no less, when I was a kid. We weren't even a regular church-going family in those days, but his talks about the faith were so clear and compelling that my mom and dad always tuned in. I was fascinated by the cape he wore. It gave him a sort of superhero quality. Well, Sheen was a great communicator on the personal level as well. He brought many people into the church, some of whom had very complex personal stories. One of the most colorful was Bella Dodd, who had been an active and committed communist operative. Mary Nichols, a retired physician and researcher, and Paul Kenger of Grove City College tell about this remarkable conversion in The Devil and Bella Dodd, a new offering from Tan Books. Paul Kenger is with us. Professor Kenger, this has to be one of the most remarkable faith journeys of modern times. Give us some background on Bella Dodd and how her life was changed by her association with Fulton Sheen.
Yeah, well, thanks, Bill. Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot of background, but I'll try to summarize. This sweet little Italian girl from Paterno, Italy, born in 1904, with this lovely Italian name, Maria Assunta Isabella Visono, which means Blessed Mother of the Assumption, right? Maria Assunta. She comes to New York 5 years later because her father, family wanted to move here for a better living, or at least in terms of making more money, more financial success. And she ends up being enrolled in the New York City public school system, where she's first introduced to socialism, goes to Hunter College, where she's introduced to communism, goes to Columbia University, where she becomes a communist. And she ends up leaving this kind of idyllic life in Italy to come to the United States and become this communist organizer, agitator, and master infiltrator, but particularly starting with the teachers' unions. At one point, she testified before Congress, and this was confirmed by congressional investigations. Out of 10,000 members of the New York State Teachers' Union, she helped to place 1,000 to 1,500 Communist Party members. So the party started looking to her as an organizer. She joined the party. She really became part of the party in the 1932 through the 1940s, but she became an open card-carrying Communist Party member in 1943. Among the other things that she did, and I know that you probably want to ask about this, but she was so good at infiltration that the party even went to her at one point, as she put it, to help place, quote, over 1,000 communist men, unquote, into Catholic seminaries, beginning in the mid-1930s, 1936. And I should add here that the party was already doing this with Protestant seminaries. They were already doing this in Eastern Europe. They were already doing this to the Soviets. The Kremlin was doing it to the Russian Orthodox Church. So for her to go after the Catholic Church, as Louis Boudens, who had been the editor of the Daily Worker, another convert of Fulton Sheen, he testified before Congress that the communists planned nothing less than the total infiltration of the Catholic Church as a plan for the destruction of Christianity. And Bella Dodd, quite sadly, quite tragically, became part of that.
Why her for that particular assignment? Did she continue in her involvement with the church?
She had been a Catholic as a child. She kind of slowly went away from the faith. It was hard to say that she ever became an atheist. Her professor, her English professor at Hunter College, Sarah Parks, Bella Dodd told a story about how at one point Bella, sort of still clinging to the faith, wrote this nice paper on monasticism and how she found it attractive. And Comrade Parks called her into her office and said, I do not like this paper, telling her instead that she ought to be writing about the glories of the Jacobins and the French Revolution. Vladimir Lenin once referred to his Bolsheviks as glorious Jacobins. So that was all part of pulling her away from the faith. Mm. But by the time that she left the party, and that's another story into itself, and was really expelled by the party in June 1948, at that point, she was longing to go back to her faith. And she spent about 3 years truly in the wilderness, a kind of a wandering lost soul, being followed by both the KGB and the FBI at the same time. And she had kind of an epiphany where she was in Washington, D.C., visiting with her congressman from New York, Congressman McGrath. This was 1951. And he said to her, "Bella, you look really troubled. Isn't there anything I could do for you?" She said, "No, I've got the KGB following me, the FBI following me." And he said, "Bella, would you like to see a priest?" And she said, kind of from the depth of her soul, she just said, "Yes." So McGrath turned to his secretary, Rose, and said, "Rose, why don't you call Monsignor Sheen at Catholic University?" They called him on the spot, and he said, "I know who Dr. Dodd is. Send her over to my apartment tonight." And she went over and visited him. She walked to the door. He opened the door. He was standing there with his giant pectoral cross. She said, "Just like on television, just like on Life is Worth Living." And instead of talking to her like the Bolsheviks did, and in her words saying, "You old Bolshevik bag, you hag, what are you doing in here?" He was all mercy and all kindness, and he said, "Doctor, come in. I'm glad that you came." And he put his hand on her shoulder, and she just started to sob, started to cry. And he comforted her and said, "There, there, it's okay, it's okay." She said within about 15 minutes, she found herself with him on her knees in front of a statue of the Blessed Mother in his private chapel, praying. He gave her a rosary, and he said, after that night, the end of that night, he said, "I'm going to be going back to New York in the spring. Why don't you come meet me in my office, and I'll give you instruction into the faith." And he did. And she ended up coming back to the faith, St. Patrick's Cathedral. He heard her confession April 7th, 1952, and she was back and standing with the church.
That's a remarkable story. And she went on to become quite fiercely anti-communist. She testified before Congress. She became a spokesperson for liberty, really. It was an amazing change.
She did. And in fact, I should add here, April 7, 1952, he heard her confession. And then exactly 3 weeks later, on the cover of the New York Times, they ran an article on page one, which said, "Fulton Sheen in Rome speaks of red infiltration of the priesthood." And he was at St. Susanna Church, an American church in Rome. And he said that orders had been given out in 1936 in a large American city to infiltrate the priesthood. And Bill, he could have only gotten that information from Bella Dodd, And Fulton Sheen never talked about it again after that. Bella Dodd never talked about it publicly, except on one occasion at a speech in Orange County, California in the 1960s. And we interviewed two people for the book who were there. Fulton Sheen told Bella Dodd, "I don't want you to talk about this publicly, this infiltration of the church. I think it would cause a scandal." And she said, "Bishop Sheen, I want to go spend the rest of my life in the harshest, most severe penitential order on the planet for forgiveness for my sins, for what I did." And he said, "No, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go tell the world about the dangers of communism and what they've done. That's what I want you to do." And she said, "Okay, that's what I'll do." And she spent the rest of her life doing just that.
Wow. Great story. How did you get onto this, you and your colleague Mary Nicholas? What prompted you to pursue this particular story?
Well, Mary Nicholas, my co-author, she's an MD, medical doctor, and she's followed this her entire life. Bella Dodd has become kind of almost an obsession for Mary. And Bella Dodd had, no one had ever written a biography of her. She did a memoir, a best-selling memoir called School of Darkness, which was a double metaphor, right? Not only for the School of Darkness, the education front that she had penetrated with the teachers union, but for the Communist Party as well and what it did. But there had never been a biography of her. And for me personally, I had come across Bella Dodd many times because my kind of lifelong research area is communism, Cold War, the American Communist Party. I did a book called The Devil and Karl Marx, where I talked about the infiltration of churches. And I had a chapter in there on Bella Dodd. Mary Nicholas came to me years ago saying, with having trouble getting her manuscript published, asking me to be co-author. And I said, no, I don't want to jump in. This is your book. This is your book. This is your book. But after a while, in a few years, and after I saw the manuscript, and I realized that, and she's not a professional historian, and she definitely did indeed need my help. So I can't help her diagnose diseases and broken bones, right? But I can help her with research on Communist Party USA and with publishers and that sort of thing, because I've done about 20 books. So I got involved, and we working together put this together, spent a few years on it, and Tan Books published it, and now it's out.
Well, it's certainly timely. It has a whole new relevance given the turns that our national history has taken in the last couple of years and the trends that are coming upon us in such a strong and overwhelming way. I'm sure there's going to be a tremendous amount of interest in this.
Well, that's exactly right. And there's this really terrible new fascination, interest, and even support for communism in America.
Right.
In many of our churches, many of the sort of, you know, religious left-oriented congregations and denominations. And I hate to say, too, even in the Catholic Church. I mean, when the leading Jesuit publication, America Magazine, publishes an article in July 2019 called The Catholic Case for Communism, mm-hmm. I mean, we've got a problem. That article, people can look it up. It has a big photo of Evo Morales, the Bolivian tin horn dictator, handing a communist crucifix to a grinning Pope Francis.
Right.
And that, it was accompanied by an article from the editor-in-chief of America justifying why they published an article called The Catholic Case for Communism. That would have quite literally, and I'm not making this up, Bill, this is no hyperbole. That article would have gotten America Magazine and its staff excommunicated under the 1949 papal decree against communism by the Catholic Church. You know, the Catholic Church had condemned communism back to 1846 with Pius IX's Qui Pluribus, published 2 years before the Communist Manifesto was even published. Throughout the 25-year pontificate of Leo XIII, through Pius X, the 11th did Divini Redemptoris, the encyclical in 1937 that described communism as a satanic scourge created out of the pit of hell by the sons of darkness. The church has always been terrifically anti-communist. So to see things like that today at America Magazine, we got a problem, man. We got a problem.
Well, it does seem that even for a lot of well-meaning people, this idea that Christian charity is essentially a benevolent form of communism, this is a very persistent
right.
thing.
No, that's exactly right. And of course, you can be charitable. You can help the poor by doing what Jesus would do.
Right.
You don't need to do what Karl Marx would do, right? There's a gazillion ways to help the poor and your neighbor without becoming an atheistic, God-denying, religion-hating, abolition of the family, right? Abolition of private property preaching Marxist-Leninist, right? Who subscribes to an ideology that has left over 100 million people dead from the killing fields of Cambodia to China to Cuba to the Soviet Union to North Korea and on and on. The idea that, oh, the communists believe in sharing and spreading the wealth. We as Christians should be communists is one of the most incredible examples of fatuous sophistry. It just leaves you speechless.
Yet it goes on and on, especially among young people. They seem particularly enamored with this idea.
Yeah. And it shows, like, as Bella Dodd and Fulton Sheen and others realized, how easily the kind of extreme left, communist left, can dupe and mislead, as the church said, impressionable people, the unwary, who are so easily misled. And with our, kind of erstwhile Catholic colleges and not very Catholic schools today not teaching any of this stuff or any of this history, our young people don't know anything about it. So they're easily duped.
Well, this book has just recently been released. It probably hasn't gotten up to full strength distribution-wise, but if people are interested, where can they find out more about it?
Well, you can find it at Amazon, of course, or you can also go to the website of Tan Books. So just type in it, The Devil and Bella Dodd, and there you go.
The Devil and Bella Dodd, One Woman's Struggle Against Communism and Her Redemption by Mary Nichols and Paul Kanger. Paul, thank you very much. I appreciate you taking time to talk about this. It's a fascinating topic, and like I say, it couldn't be any more timely. You're bringing it out at the right moment.
Well, unfortunately so. And thank you very much, Bill. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Engaging little book titled 100 Ways John Paul II Changed the World came out a couple of years ago, and it's made quite a splash. Patrick Nowakowski is the author, and he was a guest on this show when the book first hit the stands. He's tackled all the challenges any writer faces in developing, marketing, and promoting a book, and as a writer myself, I've watched his progress with great satisfaction. I thought he might be able to share the benefits of his experience with other would-be authors, so I invited him back. Patrick, thanks for being with us once again. Give us an overview of the book and what went into it.
Sure, yeah. So I had the great honor and privilege of actually meeting Pope St. John Paul II 5 times between 1997 and 2001. Three of those were private audiences, and 2 were encounters in St. Peter's Square. At the time, I was working for the Marians of the Immaculate Conception, and I was the publicist for Eden Hill, kind of doing publicity locally for the National Shrine of Divine Mercy, and I was the associate editor of Marian Helper magazine. With the Marians, I just had the chance to go to Rome a few times, 5 times, and each time had the great honor to meet John Paul II and make some presentations to him, and so that kind of laid the groundwork for the book, because then I went on, I got married, had a few children, and then he passed away and was subsequently beatified and canonized, and then one day it hit me, oh my gosh, I didn't just meet the Pope, I met a saint, a real bona fide canonized saint. And the more I reflected on that and my experience with him, I started to give this talk on how John Paul II changed the world. I developed this list, this top 10 list, ways that he impacted the course of history and human thought and the Catholic Church and so many different things in the 20th century that I think people will be talking about for the rest of time.
What then went into it to take that basic inspiration and whatever notes and research you may have accumulated and turning it into a book? That's a big step. How did you approach that?
It was, and there was an evolution to it. You know, I did think about just writing a book on my experience with John Paul II. At the time, I was the editor of Legatus magazine. I did that for 12 years, and over the course of that work, I got to know some of the top Catholic publishers in the country, and I got to know them very well, and they got to know my work, and I also got to know people like George Weigel, who is John Paul's official biographer. And so I would bounce these ideas off Catholic publishers, and I'd bounce them off other Catholic scholars and get their feedback and their input, and that kind of helped develop that top 10 list. And then when it was late, mid 2019, I realized that his 100th birthday was coming up in May of 2020. And I had a period of time, a few months, where I just had a lull in my consulting work. Had some time to write, so I actually put 2 months solid into writing my book. Took a break for a month and then finished it out. Actually wrote it in four months, but with a 1 month break in there. And I refined it into this top 100 list of ways that he changed the world, simply on the feedback of people who knew him much better than I did.
It is true that there have been a lot of changes in the publishing industry. There was a time when a writer might just submit a manuscript and the publisher would pretty much run with it and handle everything, but that's not the way it is anymore. It all comes back to the writer. The manuscript has to be perfectly clean. You got to do your own proofreading most of the time, and then you got to put a lot of shoe leather into promoting it. What all went into bringing this thing to market?
Yeah, so I was at the Catholic Marketing Network conference in 2019, and I had conversations with several Catholic publishers, and I had interest from three of the top Catholic, the most prominent Catholic publishers, and the only one that said they could bring it to press in time for his 100th birthday was our Sunday Visitor. So signed a contract with them, but it was not a slam dunk. You know, even though they knew me and I knew them, it was a lot of back and forth. And I think, I guess if I'm talking to aspiring authors, there's an old phrase that it's not what you know, it's who you know. That's so true in every aspect of business, but it's also true in ministry. The more you are known and the more your work is known, the easier it will be to get recognition and to get the attention of these publishers. They're being bombarded with book ideas, and not only can they only publish a small sliver of what comes across their desks, but they can only look at a small sliver and analyze a small sliver of what comes across their desks. And you could either get lucky and have them evaluate your work and like your work, or you can, as you said, go through a lot of shoe leather to get yourself known. And that comes through just, you know, building your online presence, developing your own network of people who are potentially buyers of your book, have your work known through social media. You almost have to develop yourself into a celebrity in order to get attention these days. And it shouldn't have to be that way. You know, you should be able to be just an excellent writer who is only known by your name, but it's not that world anymore.
Yeah, a lot of things have changed. It's a very tough market. Is there one capsule of advice that you would give a young writer trying to break in?
Yeah, read good writing. Read good writing. One thing that I actually learned this from Will Smith, and not only Will Smith, but Tom Hanks as well. I love good acting as well as I love good writing. And one of the things that both of these guys did is they, especially Will Smith, I read this once that he analyzed the scripts of movies that were blockbusters. He went through and he analyzed what made this such a good film. And he went down to the writing. You know, it's good writing, it's compelling writing. And so he analyzed that, and he would use that formula to choose his work, the work that he would want to, you know, put his name on. So my advice to writers is read excellent writing and analyze not only the content, but the structure and the style, and really, you know, come to grips with what makes this an excellent work, and then start incorporating that into your own work. There's a great book that I want to recommend. I'm not a big Stephen King fan, but he wrote a book called On Writing, and it talked about his experience of being rejected so many times. And he actually kept, and this is in the day when you would write a novel, you'd mail it in, you'd wait for a response from the publisher by mail. Sometimes it would take months and sometimes years before you would get a reply. It would either be, hey, we want to publish your work, or no, no, thank you. He kept a stack of these rejection slips on his desk, and he looked at them every day. But he persisted in writing and refining his writing and analyzing his writing and looking at other excellent writers and figuring out what they did to make it excellent. So I recommend that book. It's the only Stephen King book I have, the only one I will ever own. It's called On Writing. And it really helped me to hone my craft, to become, to analyze good work and to read good work. And also you know, beyond just the writing, networking, go to Catholic conferences, talk to people who are prominent in the Catholic world and get to know them, get them to know you, develop relationships, not only with Catholic celebrities, quote unquote celebrities, but other Catholic leaders, and get them to know your work. I had my book endorsed by George Weigel, by Raymond Arroyo, and I got to know these people by showing up at Catholic conferences, getting to develop relationships with them. Rick Santorum, I met him a couple of times, stayed in touch, and he endorsed my books. Again, it comes down to not only how good you are and what you know, but also who you know. And then when it comes time to publish your work, getting those endorsements from people that are able to kind of get you noticed a little bit.
Well, I'm not above giving a little commercial here, so how can people find out more about your book?
They can find out more about me. I've got a couple websites. CatholicPublicist.com is my website for the PR work that I do for Catholic organizations. My writer website is PatrickMilikoski.com, and if you can't spell that, go to BooksByPatrick.com.
And I assume that you've been able to get 100 Ways John Paul II Changed the World on all of the mainstream sites. I know it's on Amazon and Goodreads and all of that.
Yeah. It's basically wherever you can find good books. Our Sunday Visitor published it. It's on their bookstore. EWTN has it on their bookstore. Ave Maria Radio has it on their bookstore. And then I really wrote the book primarily for people that grew up after John Paul II died. That'd be, you know, the people who are later in the millennials and people born in the 21st century who really didn't have a lived experience of John Paul II. This book is really a primer for them to kind of wrap their heads around who he was and how he actually did change the world in so many ways.
Patrick Novikoski, 100 Ways John Paul II Changed the World. Thank you, Patrick. I appreciate you sharing your experiences and your advice.
My pleasure, Bill. God bless you.
Please let me know what you think about these shows. Tell me what books you're reading, what media you follow, what sort of music communicates with your soul. I'd love your suggestions on topics we might explore that touch the lives of Catholics today, important ideas we might discuss, interesting people we might speak with. Email me with your thoughts at billcastle@sbcglobal.net. Be with us next time when we explore other aspects of religious communication and look deeper into the great Christian heritage of free expression. Free Expression with Bill Castle is a production of Good Shepherd Catholic Radio and Company Publications, where good books, good music, and good radio are always good company. Dan Kuras provided technical assistance. Theme and incidental music are by Dan Adam. The program was produced and directed by Bill Castle. This is Good Shepherd Catholic Radio.